But I'm going to start this off by talking about our addiction to carbon, the embeddedness of carbon in UK lifestyles, and why kicking the habit is so hard. So before I go any further, I'd like to acknowledge that this work is done joint with Tim Jackson, and also the rebound effect work that I'll be talking about is also done joint with Mona Chitlis, who is here, and Steve Sorrell from Sussex University. So an overview of what I'm going to talk about now is consumption accounting, which I've really explained already. What do we do with our carbon? Why is it so hard for us to kick the habit? And how much carbon do we need for a decent life? So, importantly, we use consumption perspective accounting, which I think I've already explained to you. Basically, we include the emissions embodied in imports. So we have the emissions due to our consumption. And to do this, we've developed a framework called SELMA, the Surrey Environmental Lifestyle Mapping Framework. And as I said earlier, the emissions attributed to UK consumption are rising. So, if we look at UK household carbon emissions, for an average UK household, and this was 2004 figures, we have three categories of emissions. We have direct emissions due to our travel, and that's due to the petrol and diesel that we put in our personal vehicles. We have direct household emissions, and that's emissions that arise due to the gas and electricity we use in our households. That's like for keeping our households warm, heating our hot water, powering our appliances and our gadgets. And that makes up nearly a quarter of our carbon footprint of a household. And around two-thirds of a carbon footprint is actually embedded emissions. And these are the emissions that are embedded in goods and services that we use. And these are harder to appreciate because they're, say, the emissions embedded in the clothing that we wear and things like that. And they make up 66%, but what's quite important about them is that the percentage of embedded greenhouse gas emissions that arise abroad is increasing. So those are emissions that arise, say, in China and places like that, in production and distribution of goods and services that we as UK householders consume or purchase. One thing that struck me when I was looking at the household carbon footprint is how important travel is. It makes up around 27% of a carbon footprint. And I was surprised by this, that it's so high. It's very much dominated by personal transportation. And that's about 18% of an entire carbon footprint. And interestingly, only about half of that 18% is due to the fuel we put in our vehicles. A lot of it is embedded emissions in the production and distribution of our cars, but also there's a whole network of infrastructure around our personal vehicle use. There's all those garages that provide the petrol and service our vehicles. There's the tyre manufacturers, etc., producing tyres for our cars. There's the AA Association, and they're all included in this travel figure. Aviation is around 5% of the carbon footprint. That's without an uplift factor. And that's relatively small. But the problem with aviation emissions is that they are increasing fast. They're the fastest increasing sector. And, of course, they're very much to do with our aspirations and, therefore, a very difficult hot potato for governments to deal with. But what I'm really much more interested in is what do we do with our carbon? What activities do we use our carbon for? Do we lose more of it for our social lives, for our aspirational recreation and leisure? Or is much more to do with the struggle for existence and keeping ourselves warm and fed? So this graph shows you high-level functional uses. And what I've done here is I've got food and catering here. So under food and catering, I put everything to do with food and catering in there. So that includes like the electricity for powering our fridges and freezers and our dishwashers. It includes the emissions from the water use, from washing our veg and things like that. It includes our driving to the supermarkets to buy our food. So what we find here is that recreation and leisure is around 27% of our entire carbon footprint. And I thought it was interesting to look at that in a little bit more detail. And you'll see, in fact, I've broken down these categories in a lot more detail in one of the papers. But one of the things I decided to look at was holidays. How much of the carbon footprint is due to our holidays? And we find around 10% of the carbon footprint is due to our holidays. And that, if you think about it, if we only, I don't know what the average holiday is per year of an average UK household, say 2-3 weeks, but we use 1/10 of our carbon footprint on our holidays. And that could be thought of as disproportionate, perhaps. And that means that non-holiday recreation and leisure is about 17% of our entire footprint, and that's high as well. Looking at food in more detail, it makes around nearly a quarter of the carbon footprint is due to food, and that's very much dominated by embedded greenhouse gas emissions. And one thing I thought that was useful when looking at this, and something that I'm quite curious about myself, is whether we should eat in or we should eat out. Now let's have a poll here. When you eat at home, you've got people who put a baked potato in an oven for an hour, and so you've got, you know, gas or electricity going for an hour for one baked potato. They put in their frozen ready meals in the oven for an hour and heat that up, and we've all got our own electric appliances in our houses, and we all drive to the supermarkets, etc. On the other hand, restaurants and canteens, you've got a huge infrastructure of all those restaurants, cafes and canteens around the place. You've got the huge wastage. So is it better to eat a meal in or meal out? Okay, let's hands up if you think it's better to eat a meal out. Hands up if you think a meal in. And hands up if you really don't know. Okay. Well, I was gutted. It's actually a meal out produces around 71 to 83% more greenhouse gas emissions than a meal eaten in the home. Very upsetting for me who hates cooking, but never mind.
What about takeaways?
Takeaways are, I think they're included in restaurants and canteens. So, well, from all this, and looking in more detail, we know that carbon is deeply embedded in our lifestyles. So one thing we needed to look at is why is it so hard to kick the habit? We know there are all sorts of things published, you know, drive less, walk more, stop wasting food, etc., etc., etc. So why does it seem to be such an uphill struggle to reduce our carbon emissions? And that one of the reasons is the rebound effect. So if I explain a very simple a rebound effect, you can take an action as a UK household, very simple action such as, you know, not wasting so much food. And that should give you an expected amount of greenhouse gas emissions reduction. It will also save you money. But you're going to reuse that money. You might re-spend it on other goods and services, or you could be perhaps more intelligent about it, and you could put it in the bank or invest it. But whatever you do with it, you'll have greenhouse gas emissions due to its reuse. And the rebound effect is the ratio of the greenhouse gas emissions due to its reuse divided by the expected greenhouse gas reductions. And it's possible that you get actually more greenhouse gases due to the reuse of the expenditure, that's reuse of the money, than the expected greenhouse gas reductions, in which case you'll get backfire. In which, if you get backfire, it would have been better not to have done that action at all. So what we've done is a study of three very, very simple abatement actions. We looked at reducing the household thermostat by 1 degree, reducing food waste, and replacing short journeys by car, by walking or cycling. So So what did we find? What we found out was the way you reuse that avoided expenditure is absolutely critical. If you spend it in the sort of behaviour as usual way, which is according to income elasticities, we found the rebound effect is around 34%. That means that you only actually achieve around two-thirds of your hoped-for greenhouse gas emissions reductions. Depending on how you reuse that money saved, if you use it in the worst greenhouse gas category, we find that you get extreme backfire, so it's really not worth having done the action at all. And an example of that might be perhaps going on a flight. So you save money on your gas bills, and you actually go on holiday somewhere on a cheap flight. It might have been better not to have done that. But what we do find is that if you put more money into savings, you can reduce the rebound. And in fact, if you have very green investments, which actually give off coming down to zero carbon, you can actually get the rebound effect towards zero. And you can actually imagine if you put in your money into ultra-green investments that actually suck carbon out of the atmosphere, you could get a negative rebound effect, so you amplify the good actions that you've done. So there are possibilities there. But what it has shown, that work, is that it's very important to focus on incomes, because what you do with that avoided expenditure is very vital. So, what incomes do we need? What are the necessities for flourishing? What of our consumption can we do without, and which actually is very necessary? So what we've done is a study that's looked at the minimum income standard carbon footprint. Now, the minimum income standard is something that's done by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. And they've drawn up a basket of expenditures in order to find out the income that's necessary to meet a minimum acceptable standard of living in the UK. And that, importantly, this standard of living not only includes subsistence needs, but very importantly, participation in society. And the expenditures are drawn up in great detail by members of the public. And what we did was find the carbon footprint of this minimum income standard. And what we found was that you can have a 37% reduction compared to the carbon footprint as per a normal UK household. Now that's significant, but it's not enough. So just to draw this talk to an end, what have we learnt from it? Well, I think one of the things that comes out from it is that we do need to rethink our aspirations about ever-increasing incomes. And, of course, Juliet has talked about that this morning. And we need to work out how we can flourish on lower carbon. What makes us happy? In fact, you know, if you look at surveys, it's communication and being with friends and family that makes us happy, not buying all this stuff. So we need to think about that a bit more. And we also need to address the systems of provision. As Juliet said, of course, earlier this morning, it is impossible for any householder to actually do all this by themselves. We are locked into certain systems of provision. And just those figures on transportation that I showed you earlier show that, you know, without the infrastructure, there's not a lot we can do as individuals. We are not able to do it without bigger picture, looking at the systems of provision. And we must also, very importantly, pay attention to distribution of the quality of life. Now, all my figures earlier were for an average UK household, but it's very important that we do look at different levels of society, and the people who are already suffering must not be more hurt by our environmental efforts. And Tracy will actually talk a lot more about that in her talk. So there's some references, and thank you very much. I think we've got time for one or two questions. Okay, right at the back.
Hi there, thanks very much. I'm wondering whether there's a slight contradiction with what Juliet was talking about, which is about work hours, whereas you seem to be saying that leisure, i.e. free time, actually increases an awful lot of carbon emissions as well. Do you see a contradiction or not really?
No, I think what we're doing is confounding the production and the consumption perspective. Because in my carbon footprint, I don't have hours of work. Because your hours of work go into producing things. And it, what we're doing here from the consumption perspective is looking at private household expenditure. We've done another study that's looking about time use and what we do with our leisure time. And there are different ways of spending your leisure time. It seems to me that one of the best ways of actually spending your leisure time is in fact sitting around at home watching telly, you know, depending on the heating of your household and things. When you look at leisure time, it's very important. The travel comes out as a very important component. Any part of your leisure time that has travel is very highly greenhouse gas intensive. So I think you're sort of comparing apples and pears with that one, but we can talk about more later.
Thanks, it was great. Thank you. Just a quick one. When you're looking at the one of the earlier graphs and you're looking at the food, for example, you've got your the travel to the supermarket in that.
Yes.
Is there, does it all add up, or is that also counted in another section?
Okay. That pie chart of all the emissions all adds up, yes. What I've done is looked at things in different ways, like...
Is that one, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. What I did, first of all, I looked at travel, okay? Travel on its own separately,
right.
And that was 27% of the carbon footprint. Forget that.
Yeah.
Now we put travel into all the things that it's used for, because I said I had the cauldron, and what do we use our carbon for? So then all that travel has been distributed to the various things. So all the travel to do with recreation and leisure is in recreation and leisure. So that includes all the aviation, and all the travel to the supermarkets was in food, and the travel for clothing is in clothing.
You've got caring.
Have I got care?
Okay.
I have. I can give you more detailed figures, and it's actually in one of the publications, but you'd need to talk to me to find out more about it. Yes?
In your talk, there was one word that maybe the economist to me, but it was missing, and that's prices for carbon.
Okay.
That in your discussion of what can be done, I mean, from a standard economics model, the reason that we are consuming carbon the way we are is because we see a zero price for it. And if we see something other than a zero price, our behavior would change accordingly. And I was just surprised that that word was not mentioned.
Okay, well, prices are very important, especially when we look at the rebound effect, because prices will affect the income elasticities and price elasticities of how we spend our money. So it is implicit in the work, but I haven't looked at it. I think Mona will be talking much more about prices later on. But this work looks at the status quo and how we can move it. And of course, carbon, one of the conclusions from the rebound work and any other work is that we need to shift our whole basket of expenditures to lower carbon intensive goods and services to make our basket lower intensity overall. And one of the obvious things is to change the price through a carbon tax. How are we for time?
We think. Can I ask a couple more questions?
A couple more questions. There and then there.
Just wondering if you could say a little bit about how you get the statistics, where you get the carbon statistics for the UK, and particularly how you go about getting the statistics for embedded consumption.
Okay.
Is there a Chinese equivalent of the Environment Agency that does that? Or?
Yeah. Okay, embedded, all these figures come from national level data sets publicly available. At the centre of Selma, the model is an environmental input output model, and I think it's too complicated to go into, but it is a methodology, it's quasi-multi-regional input-output model, which takes environmental data and basically supply chain data that shows it, takes the whole model of the economy, divides it into sectors, and has a complete shows which sector purchases from which other sector, and therefore you get all supply chain emissions attributed to final consumption. And yes, there are input-output models that you can do with whichever country you're concerned with. So there are people who do it for China, people who do it for America, people who do it for the Netherlands, etc. And one more I said there, didn't I?
Yeah, your three rebound studies took the three actions like reducing temperature in the house and reducing food waste. To what extent did you find people knew exactly how much money they were saving? Or was it more a psychological effect of I'm saving some money, therefore I can buy a discrete thing like a flight?
Okay, did everyone hear that question? Yeah. Again, this was done from high-level data sets, national data sets. So what we did, we haven't been to talk to people about it, which is actually a very good question, thank you, because it would be interesting. So we didn't talk to people about it. What we've done is worked out the money that would be saved by this. But, interestingly, I mean, there's one good quote there. I think it was on the NHBC, National Housing Association, did an interview of people and said if you save money on your heating bills, how would you spend that money? And the biggest number of people said they'd go on a holiday abroad. So, you know, but the other thing is that, in fact, most of us, because we pay sort of monthly, quarterly, or whatever, we don't think of it as, oh, I've saved, you know, £10 this month or whatever. And it actually just goes into the general pot of money. Except for, of course, perhaps lower income households might actually say, I've saved £5, what should I do with it?
Okay. Brilliant. Tracy, can we carry on? And we'll pick up some more questions.